Okay, this will be talking with James W. Phillips over the phone from Carnegie to his house and his home in Cheltenham, Gloucestershire in England, where he's now retired. And I've called him up a couple times before to tell him what I'm about. He's also written me a letter. But anyway, we'll be recording this now. This is 31 August 78.
Now, just going through your letter, first of all, there was a few points that I'd like to ask about. Were you directly involved in the interference which came from the sun, which Hay discovered in 1942? No. I gather from the letter that you didn't come back to his group until 1945, is that correct?
1944. I joined it. It was the time of the first V2. In fact, I was in London waiting to report when the first V2 landed, and I think that was October 44.
I see. And you say you were working in the field in Northern Europe until May 45. Does that mean that you were going out into the field and then back to the lab?
Yes. We had, as a group, our commitment there, and our main commitment, this is the radar group. The group was concerned with trying to spot V2s, and I went out to Northern Europe, Ostend and Holland, Belgium rather, not in Holland, trying to get a line on the track.
I see. Now, can I ask, what was your training, and what was the primary sort of thing that you worked on during the war?
This is a very interesting question. I wonder if it'll probably horrify you when you hear the answer. I got a mathematics degree, and I was a mathematics teacher before the war. People with any sort of scientific qualification were put on a register and
yes.
Not allowed to go into the normal army channels. And were called on as required.
Right.
Well, by the time the radar blew up, all the people who really knew anything about either engineering, electrical engineering, or radio, were already in signals or Royal Engineers or something like that. So they really had to scrape the barrel in order to man the radar post. And they were at the bottom of the barrel, they found people like me, who really knew nothing whatever about radio.
Well, but you had a scientific mind, so to speak.
I had a scientific mind, yes. But, for instance, I thought of something that
you
stored electricity in.
Right.
So. So. Radio knowledge. Anyway, they gave us a rush course, put us out into the field of civilians, and then in court, after about a year, brought us back, gave us some sort of elementary military training, put us into uniform, and then from there, as it happened, I took two more courses in the Army, postgraduate courses, and by the end of the war, I was really quite knowledgeable on these things.
I see. And so, what sort of problems would be typical of what you'd be working on?
What, during the Army?
Yes.
Oh, I was just servicing and maintaining radar equipment in the field, principally AA command.
I see. Okay. Well, now, when you joined Hay's group in 1945,
yes.
Or I should say, you had joined it before, but... what I want to get at is, can you tell me what the makeup of the group was when you first were able to work on scientific matters as opposed to military matters?
Well, it was a section of a much larger organization. You know that.
Well, go ahead, tell me.
The idea of Operation Research Groups was thought up during the war, and each of the services, I think, had the biggest one was the RAF one, the Air Force one,
mm-hmm.
Lovell, I think, was in that. So there was a smaller one attached to the Army, which used to concern itself with various problems other than radar. Our particular section was radar, and this was led by Hay.
I see. And how many people would be in this section in total?
Something like six officers and probably a dozen. It was mixed army and civilian, so when I say officers, these could be civilian or armed.
And did yourself and Stewart and Parsons all were officers in this group before?
Yes, I was a military officer. Parsons was a military officer, Stewart was civilian.
Right. Now, are there any other people who worked at all on the radio astronomy aspects whose names I should know?
No, the radio astronomy, of course, didn't start up until May.
Right.
I think it's May. No, I think it would be fair to say that we four led our respective
right.
sections and we were assisted as required.
And also, while I think of it, let me get the first names of these people. First of all, Parsons. It's S.J. And Stewart? Do you remember this?
I don't think we used Christian names very much in those days.
Yeah.
Stewart was Gordon Stewart, I think.
Gordon. Yes, it's G.S., right.
And Hay must have been...
Hay is John, I believe. Okay. Now, could you describe what the principal role that each person played in the group was, and how this was decided, more or less?
Well, when I came back, the thing was already a going concern on the radio astronomy. I came back in May 45. One of the reasons for this was that, as you know, the war in Europe stopped very suddenly.
Right.
And it was a policy in England not to send all the army back into the labour market at one go, as they'd done in the previous war, and stopped everything.
Right.
So they had an extended release. And this meant there were a lot of people in the army with absolutely nothing whatever to do.
I see.
And the army was only too happy for anybody to find anything for them.
I see.
Well, Hay was able, therefore, to get as much assistance as he required, although, in fact, we couldn't use very much, and to get equipment, existing equipment, and convert it to our uses. And he obviously got all that going very quickly, but I wasn't there at the time. I was still in Europe.
Now, when you say when you arrived, then the work was going on these short echoes from the meteors.
Yes.
The short scatter echoes, I guess.
That was well underway. I never had much to do with that. I don't really think I can tell you anything. My own work, he had assembled this Voyager array and was plotting the received signals and plotting them against celestial coordinates. And he got a large globe, something like an 18-inch school globe.
Right.
Which is what I've used in school, and was plotting onto this.
I see.
And he asked me to take this over. Well, there were various contributions I was able to make directly because of my mathematical training.
Right.
One of which was to make the necessary transfers from a spherical globe onto a plane sheet.
Right.
And the other one was to develop what would now be called a relaxation method for plotting the results, because one had to take into account the signal received on side lobes, which were quite large.
Yes, you mentioned this in your letter. Is this what I would think of as a restoration method, trying to restore the true brightness distribution?
Yes.
I've never heard this term, relaxation method. Where does that come from?
Relaxation would be a name I think which would be recognized in numerical methods.
I see, okay. But now going back to this equipment, so you say that it was put together for this purpose. It wasn't just taken over from the military.
Well,
I mean, as a unit, anyway.
Not as a unit, although a very large part of it exists. For instance, that 5 meters were very sensitive to the state of the ground echo.
Right.
So it had an artificial ground, which is tied to the paper.
Right. And that would not be usually used for the military?
Yes. That was the normal AA command.
Oh, that was a normal thing, I see.
In fact, it was a normal AA command station, which was set up in Richmond Park for research and training purposes.
I see. So this Richmond Park station had been going during the war also?
Oh, yes.
I see.
In fact, when I first did my training, I went out to the safe places back in 1941, for a brief field experience.
Right.
And then the research station was just outside Richmond, the offices were just outside Richmond Park at Roehampton, and we used it. Well, that then was existing. The cabin with its method of rotating was existing, but the aerial array was one that was set up for the job.
I see. Did you know at that time, as you were doing this work, about Jansky and Reber's work? Did you have those papers in hand?
Yes, I think that the awareness of this, the carrying on from this, must have been entirely Hay's work.
Mm-hmm.
That was all very much there.
Right. Now, as you were taking these data, what would be your normal operational procedure? Can you sort of describe it?
Yes. We were in fixed elevation, somewhere about 12 degrees, because of the effects of the ground.
Right.
Although the aerials themselves are quite horizontally. And so, during the course of the 24 hours, quite a large part of the sky is swept through our beam, upwards at one time of the day and then downwards against the other.
Right.
Parts, of course, were never visible. The circumpolar regions weren't visible, ever. And nor, of course, were the parts that were below the horizon. So that gave us a pretty wide band around the sky, which we then just took spot readings on. These were readings from a meter. We didn't have any automatic recording.
I see. You recorded them by hand from a meter.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And recorded these at appropriate intervals, something like half an hour or something, doing a complete rotation in azimuth every half hour, taking logs, and then plotting them onto a chart.
I see. So would you do this half hour after half hour after half hour, just a long
that
period of...
That would be the sort of thing, yes. It's all very primitive, of course.
But rather tedious, too.
Yes. The work was shared between two or three of us. It was only one person required. I remember, for instance, that I would do a night watch going... Of course, it went on night and day. Do a night watch, say, starting at 9 o'clock in the evening and carrying through until 8 o'clock next morning when someone came to relieve me.
Right.
Setting my alarm to ring at 20 minutes ahead, going to sleep, waking up, going out, walking out on a winter's night across the netting on a catwalk, taking my reading, coming back and getting another quarter of an hour sleep.
Now, I don't quite follow how you could get away with doing it only every 20 minutes or so.
Well, of course, the beam itself wasn't that narrow, so as you see, we weren't getting very high discrimination.
But you were rotating on the sky, though.
Yes, well, every 20 minutes was, of course, to allow for the rotation into the sky. We did a complete azimuth at 10 degree intervals, something like that. 5 degree intervals, I'm not sure.
I'm still a little bit confused. Were you at a fixed azimuth and then waiting for the sky to move through and taking a recording every 20 minutes?
Every 20 minutes we did a complete circuit.
That's what I thought. So then.
So
then it would seem like you could take a reading every minute or half minute and have a different point in the sky.
Yes, except the beam wasn't that narrow, you see.
Well, was it that broad? Was it 30 degrees or 40 degrees?
No, but the sky doesn't move that fast.
Well, but you're moving around in azimuth, so you're looking at different parts of the sky.
See, that's so you're taking a complete survey of the sky every half an hour, you see.
Yeah.
And those points were on a line at, I imagine, 5 degree intervals, although I couldn't be sure.
Okay, so you were recording many different points during the half hour.
Yes, in fact, a circuit in azimuth would, I should imagine, take something like 5 or 8 minutes, something like that. And then we would take no more until we went round again. Another half hour later.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. So you would take a quick circuit and then wait a half an hour, then take another circuit.
That would be the whole thing.
I have in mind Jansky's procedure, which was continuous every 20 minutes, and he had a strip chart recorder, so he got continuous recording. That's what was confusing me. So you were just taking it, waiting for the sky to move, taking it again.
That's right.
I've got you. Okay, then what was the procedure to reduce this data?
Recording, certainly not at that time, which in many ways is a good thing, because if we did get on automatic recording, we then were faced with the problem of getting someone to analyze the endless rolls of charts which came off automatic recorders.
Right.
And that's a bigger problem than recording. Anyway, so we would have a lot of spot levels, and then this is where this would become my job with close assistance from a junior member of the team. I already had a large, I should say 5 foot square, something like that, sheet of perspex gridded
suitably
and so on. And I'd work with a China graph pencil. I had a rotating overlay, a transparent overlay, which represented the characteristics of the beam.
I see.
And I just pop my way around, make the corrections as required, restoring it, to use your term, until, one got a pattern of the whole sky, but of course you'd need a complete 24 hours reading before you could start working on this.
Right. Now, how many of these complete maps of the sky did you make in practice?
I don't really think I can say. Our technique improved from time to time, and we would try again. and indeed one of the major surveys we set up and started blew up because the sun got active.
Right. Well, we'll come to that shortly. But I'm wondering, unfortunately, I don't have a copy of your 1946 letter to Nature. Was that just based on one sampling of the sky, or did you do two or three?
I think it's like it would be one sampling of the sky. I can't remember now.
Yeah. So in any case, you did take several, you made several independent maps of the sky, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. There'd be a fair amount of averaging now.
Right, right. Now, what sort of units were you making these plots in, and how did you do your intensity calibration?
We were using a bare tungsten wire diode as our standard.
Right.
I think that's referred to in the North side of the paper.
Yes. And so, how did you calibrate it, though? Were you trying to do it in terms of a temperature? It's probably
I
in that.
I think, yeah.
Yeah. What about the measurement of the beam characteristics?
Well, for this purpose, we flew an oscillator.
I see.
And we had an RAF team attached to the surface who had a delightful life because they weren't called on very often. But the RAF, like us, have got a lot more people that they knew what to do.
Right.
So they lived with us, and we flew a balloon, went to conditions promised to be suitable, flying an oscillator up and down and rotating the cabin and trying to plot the beam.
I see. Okay. Now, talking about things that can go wrong, you mentioned the thing about the sun blowing up one day. Can you tell me about that?
Well, normally, the quiet sun we couldn't see. The sensitivity and the wavelength was such that we couldn't see.
Was all of your work at 5 meters? Or did you?
At that time, I think I'm right in saying it was all 5 meters. But I wouldn't be able to be sure.
Certainly all my work. Well, in any case, you had no strong urge to try to look at another wavelength to see the spectrum of the radiation.
I rather think we tried at 10 centimeters and didn't get anything, as you probably know, the spectrum.
Yeah, that's a big jump, right.
You've got to have a fairly good apparatus. I think it wasn't really until they got the really big bowls that they started to get anything at the shorter wavelength.
What did you have for an antenna at 10 centimeters?
Well, it would have been a standard gun control radar.
Just a small little dish, probably?
About, again, I would say about 4 foot.
Mm-hmm.
And the beam width probably about 2 degrees.
I see. Okay, back to the other question about the sun interference.
Yes, well, we were all set up, and we were going to start at sunrise, and as it happened, I put my members of my team onto being there at sunrise, and I turned up at about 8 o'clock in the morning just to make sure it was going all right. It wasn't going all right at all, because the sun was doing a great deal and really blowing everything else off the air. If you were anywhere near the sun, you couldn't get anything at all.
I see. So it was readily recognized as the sun.
Immediately, yes.
And so, according to your letter, then, you began to start monitoring the sun, then?
Yes.
And how long did this go on?
Well, it went on for the period of the activity, which I think was something like a week.
Mm-hmm.
Each time, no doubt, the sunspots went around the wrong side of the sun. But I would think it was about a week. It might have been slightly less.
And you say you contacted other groups. Which groups were those?
Yes, now here I really can't remember. Appleton, of course, had a set up at SLAO, which was the successors of his, the people who did his, the work on the bouncing reflections of the ionosphere.
Right.
That was still going. I think this was part of the National Physical Laboratory, I'm not quite sure. I certainly would have contacted them.
Perhaps Ryle at Cambridge?
No, I don't think Ryle was going then.
Well, let's see, when would this be? Let's get...
I think, again, I must refer you to the literature on this.
Okay.
It's written up by Appleton. Over Appleton's name, with Hay as co-author.
Oh, yes, I know the paper you mean.
And I think that will give you...
Okay.
I don't think, in fact, there's any acknowledgement to me at all for that. But, in fact, I did... Well, I was there and got the first observations and alerted such people as we were in touch with.
Well, you'll be interested to see in Hay's book, his his paragraph about this relationship with Appleton, and he very diplomatically discusses it. For instance, saying, "With reluctance, I became aware of the pitfalls of an undefined association. Appleton's incursion into our research findings began to arouse discontent within my own team, and the liaison could not survive," and so forth.
Yes.
So I suppose this is an example of that.
Hay handled all the outside contacts, really, so I don't know very much about it.
Uh-huh.
I was really only working on my own project, and it was just because of the urgency and the novelty of the situation that I took steps to phone such people as I could think of without waiting to see anybody else.
Right. Now, did you work at all on the scientific aspects of this burst radiation?
No, that was really Hay, I think.
Okay, you just turned the data over to him, more or less.
Yes. The solar wind.
Right. Okay, along this same line, did you worry about the ionospheric effects at all in your data?
No. Apart from realizing there was some distortion near the horizon, but our beam wasn't near enough the horizon for us to be able to make any estimates. But I think really the blunter answer is that I was no scientist.
Yeah. And another thing is the man-made interference. Could you tell me about what happened there?
Well, that wasn't very troublesome. During the early part, and generally speaking, it was only temporary, so we got it one time. Well, the next time we went around, it had probably disappeared and so on. It tended to be things like electric trains and so on.
Right.
With the exception, of course, of the one which I'm sure you're going to discuss in a minute.
But now you say in the early time, now you were working with the group for a total of what, 2 or 3 years?
Well, I actually left the group in August or September 48.
Yes.
But really the work had wound down before that for reasons which I've indicated in my letter.
Right. When would that be? When it...
I should think the active time probably didn't go much into 47 probably.
Till the end of 40... You mean the end of 46, beginning of 47?
I should think that was the sort of time when our active work finished.
Right, so about a year and a half.
Our active work on radio astronomy.
Right, about a year and a half total.
Something like that.
Now, were you implying that by the end of that period that the interference problem had gotten worse?
Well, it was getting worse whilst we were in Richmond Park. And indeed, I think soon after I'd made that major survey, which was reported in the Royal Society paper, I think it really did start getting difficult. We were, of course, well within the outskirts of London.
Right.
Surrounded on all sides by electric trains and so on. Television was coming up, all sorts of things.
And so did you move at that point?
Well, we did move, but it was a protracted business. They were a long time, I think, settling into their new place up at Byfleet, and we were the last section to move.
At Byfleet, you say?
We never really got going in the new place during my time.
I see. At Byfleet, you say, was the new
Byfleet,
place?
Byfleet, yes, near Woking.
And I guess Malvern was yet later. Is that right?
Malvern wasn't really directly anything to do with that.
I see.
Malvern was basically the RAF place.
So Hay was associated with Malvern later, but that was a switch for him.
Yes. Hay moved out of AORG as I did. We were both offered posts within the civil service, the science organization. I chose to go teaching, but I don't know why. Hay was still at ARG when I left, but he left, I would think, fairly soon after, but I'm not sure.
I see. Well, okay, going back to the interference, the story you tell about the Wimbledon television transmitter is very interesting. Could you tell it to me now?
Well, this is during one of these calibrations when I used to fly an oscillator on a balloon.
Right.
And we, as the crow flies, I suppose we were about 2 miles from Wimbledon, something like that. And I flew one up to do a calibration on a nice quiet summer morning and found I was getting very large interference, which was really wrecking my results. And of course, since we had a directional array, it didn't take very long to get a line on where the interference was coming from.
Right.
And got a line straight across Wimbledon.
Right.
And then someone remembered that they were supposed to be televising from Wimbledon, so I got on the phone and said, "What the hell are you doing? You're blowing me off the air, you see."
Right.
Whereupon they said, this is all on tape incidentally, but I think it's accurate. Whereupon they said, we're just doing the run-up for the broadcast this afternoon, and we're getting wrecked. Who are you?
I see.
We then fortunately got to talking about it amicably, and it turned out that the wavelength they were using on had been assigned to them, and all army units had been advised to keep off it. But since we were rather out on a limb and not within the normal army orbit,
I see.
I mentioned it to us.
So they, in fact, were very close to your frequency then?
Yes, I think it was a relay frequency that we were wrecking. I don't think it was their main transmitting frequency.
But I don't quite understand about, you say that you blew them off the air. This was because of the oscillator on the balloon.
Yes.
Right, okay, wasn't...
Which incidentally was visible from Wimbledon, so why the post office engineers couldn't spot where the interference was coming from, I don't know.
Okay. Now, this same unit was used for the meteor radar work, is that right? Or was that another unit?
No.
Okay.
It wasn't, and I think I can say that it never was, because I think we were using a much more directional array. Probably, but I'm rather guessing, probably one mounted on a searchlight chassis. This was another form of mounted radar that was used during the war.
I see, but was it at that same site, Richmond Park?
Yes.
And did you timeshare in terms of when they were radiating that you would
no,
not
they
be...
No, they would have been using a different frequency, I think. So really, I don't think I can tell you anything useful. I think I've got to tell you nothing more than is in the literature.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you say we before you got going to the new site, the Cold War started.
Yes.
And the Army directed us to more serious things. Hay also talks about international tensions rising. I was wondering specifically what that was referring to. Is this the Berlin, or is this before then?
Well, I'm only speaking from memory, but I think it was Berlin, yes. Do you happen to know the date of the Berlin
Agreement? Well, it's 48. I think it's the first half of 48. So that would about make sense then, wouldn't it?
Yes. Well, it might have started up before then I don't know. But that was certainly about that time.
Okay. Can you tell me about, you mentioned in your letter that Hay exercised general supervision, but can you tell me sort of how the group worked? Was everyone working sort of independently and Hay just loosely?
The organization was very loose. And indeed, after, as I say, Hay started it up, but from then on, certainly as far as my side is concerned, the link was really one more of consultation and discussion of results rather than laying down orders for the day or plans of action or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And in what was actually done was very much, the decision, it certainly was in my case, the decision of the person who was doing the work, although in full consultation with Hay.
Right. So the final paper, I mean, would that be really a joint effort between you, or was it mainly that you would write it and he would approve it?
Delicate. Question and the answer's got to be delicate.
Too. Okay. I will respect that.
In fact, I think I can say I wrote the Royal Society paper, which was the substantive paper. It was certainly done in close discussion with Hay, and he would certainly have criticized the manuscripts and commented, and it would have been modified in the light of these criticisms and so on.
Right.
But basically, it was my paper.
So it might have been a fairer thing. He could still be co-author, but if you'd be senior author, something like that.
Second?
It might have been fairer. Hay could still be co-author, but you'd be senior author, perhaps.
Yes. But it is the custom in science, certainly was then,
yeah,
for the senior officer, you know, or the professor of
right.
the department or whatever.
Right.
And so we weren't in any way doing anything different, and although I did realize that my name, as I say, got submerged in the et al.
Yes.
I can't say that this was anything other than normal
right.
of the trade.
Yeah, well, that still happens today. I think it's not as common today, but it still does happen.
And indeed, until I realized, and I wasn't even enough of a scientist to realize what was going to happen, I think, until I realized what was happening, I had no qualms about it at all.
Right. So decisions as to whether another scan of the sky would be needed to fix up a certain patch of the sky or things like this was all your own...
This would be my decision.
Yeah. Now, how much were you influenced by the results of other groups at that time? Were you just sort of operating completely by yourself?
Well, I think I could say entirely by myself. It happens to me that this is the way I tend to work. I don't keep closely in touch with other people. Mm-hmm. So you will gather that from how little I know about what was going on.
Right. And so, in fact, there was really no correspondence with anyone saying that, well, we've got some results, what do you have, or anything like this?
No, I think I could say that.
Okay. When you were writing the paper for the Royal Society and the ones in Nature, and who did you feel you were writing to? Were you trying to write to astronomers, to radio engineers, radio physicists? Who did you consider your audience?
The Nature one, of course, is merely in order to register a priority.
Right.
But the Royal Society paper was obviously aimed at a wide audience, and indeed it was picked up by them. We did, for instance, have contacts with Greenwich Observatory, who were very interested in this, and we visited them and their bus. And I think, but I can't be sure of the name, I rather think that the man we talked to was the man who later became the head of the observatory, you know, the Astronomy Royal.
Richard Woolley?
No, he was the Australian, wasn't he?
Yes.
No, one who's either current or recent.
As an Astronomer Royal?
He would have been head of the observatory, I think.
At that time they were the same thing, yes. Before Woolley was Spencer Jones? Or is there someone else in there? I can't quite remember now.
I don't think we have any contact with them.
In any case, there was one astronomer you had contact with. What sort of...
a joint paper. I could dig out. I think it was a joint paper. Again, Hay handled most of the outside contacts. But I was brought in, and it was only my own fault that I didn't get in further.
This joint paper was between whom? No?
Well, it must have been between us and this man at...
Well, I have a pretty complete radio astronomy bibliography, and it does not mention any such paper.
I'll see if I can dig out a copy.
Well, that would be very interesting if you could find that.
Yes.
Indeed. What were the issues that you were discussing with this person?
Well, the obvious one was trying to identify what we got with something visual, but of course our identification was so poor, was so poor that the identification didn't really happen. We knew it was in Cygnus, and that was about as far as we could get.
Well, now, this is for the radio source, which we haven't discussed yet. But
yes. But
also, was this only for the radio source, or also for the general galactic background?
But until I look up the paper, I'd rather reserve comment on that.
Okay. Because in your Royal Society paper, you did talk quite a bit about the distribution of stars, and,
yes.
And obviously you had become educated one way or another on some of the optical structure of the galaxy.
Yes, actually, optical astronomy is something which I've always had an interest in. I watch the sun and the stars and the planets and things like this.
I see.
So that wasn't too difficult. For that reason, actually, I slipped into this very easily.
I see.
But I'd never been an observing astronomer. I'd never done any practical work.
Okay. So the only solar observations you were ever involved in was that 1 week of that active period?
No, I wouldn't like to say that.
Oh, I see. There were some. Can you tell me about the others?
On and off, the sun was pretty active for quite a long time. And indeed, as I said, one of our problems was that Parsons really put a recorder onto the machine, and we watched the sun for a long time, and the result was we got miles and miles of paper off the recorder, and then had the problem of trying to analyze it. We got rid of quite a lot of assistants who stuck it for about a week and then decided they had to find something else to do.
I see. Well, in fact...
It's a slight exaggeration, but it's the general idea.
Right. In fact...
We were observing the sun for quite a time, on and off, I think.
There is this paper by Hay, Parsons, and Phillips in Monthly Notices in 1948 about solar radio emission, mainly at 4 meters wavelength, from March 46 to September 47. And association with flares and so forth. So this must have been the automatically recorded data?
Yes, that's right.
That is a long time. That's 18 months.
Yes. Yes, well, the sun was active for a long time, and we would have had to have made our other observations during the quiet periods of the sun.
Right. Now, in this solar work also, were you in contact at all with other groups, or were you reading the literature about the sun? Or?
Well, no, I think... We had discussions with Hay, as I say, as to whether his mostly, in fact entirely, his theories about solar wind and so on could account for the observations. You know, there were the time lapses between the ultraviolet flares and the interference as received on Earth. And this
right.
Be explained in terms of some transmission or something or other.
So that was mainly Hayes' contribution.
Hay did that. Yeah.
I see.
I was in no more than entered into discussion on that.
I suppose you had contact with the Greenwich Observatory over the optical flares also.
Yes, and indeed, come to think of it, that probably was our main contact.
Yes, so maybe...
I may have been wrong in suggesting that it was to do with particulars.
Yes, maybe that's it, okay. Let's see. Hay has a description in his book where he says, I grasped the opportunity in this interim period to delve more deeply into the wealth of phenomena we had uncovered in our operational research. This is just after the end of the war. With an excellent, well-balanced team, S.J. Parsons, electrical and mechanical engineer, J.W. Phillips, mathematician, G.S. Stewart, electrical engineer, and myself, physicist, as leader, we embarked on projects utilizing modified radar for radio astronomy research. Would you agree with that description of the team?
Yes, that sounds good.
Yeah. In terms of...
He said it's a well-balanced team. In fact, we were desperately short of physicists. He was the only one. But if you call it well-balanced, yes.
Let's see. Well, as you were carrying out the survey with the galactic radiation, what was the primary question that you wanted to answer? Was it just a cartography job? You just wanted to make a map? Or were you interested
yes.
in the physics of what might be producing this radiation?
The only published results of that, the only published results of that time, I think probably I was somewhat confused, I think, at that time, because, of course, the thing which caused the trouble during the war, I think this is right, and you can verify it from Hay, was radiation from the sun.
Oh, yes, that's correct.
And although radiation from the galaxy meant that you couldn't get the sensitivity on a radar receiver that you ought to be able to get, the
right.
noise level was higher than it should have been.
Right.
I really don't think this was bothering us.
No, it's not usually a limiting factor, no.
So I think it was rather incidentally that we got onto that. And I would say that, as I say, Hay really started it. I would say that looking at the published results up to then, which was Jansky and then Reber,
right.
Reber's maps were exceedingly sketchy and slight because of the low intensity and lack of technology
well,
at the time he was working.
He couldn't detect radiation far from the galactic plane because he was operating at a good bit higher wavelength, 160 megahertz.
So although his, I think probably his angular discrimination was better, his signal was worse.
Right.
And there was obvious gaps to be filled, and we just set out to fill it.
I see. And so you weren't particularly concerned with what was producing this radiation?
Well, no. Of course, at that time, there was no reason to think that it was other than a diffuse radiation of some quite unidentified source, but it could have been interstellar gas or something like that.
Yeah. Well, in fact, in your Royal Society paper, you present these two possibilities, either interstellar gas or the summation of many sunspot-like sources
yes.
Of an unknown nature. And your conclusion is that it probably is a mixture of these two things.
Yes, and what was certain, I think, was with the wide beam we got, we wouldn't really have been able to distinguish between the two.
Yes, right.
It was only because the Cygnus result was so extraordinary and unique that we saw it at all.
So it's clear you needed...
a lot of Cygnuses, we would never be able to distinguish them.
Well, did you contemplate at all trying to go to a higher frequency or a larger antenna to get better resolution?
Well, my first interest, in fact, but this never came off because of the disruption of the moon, my first interest was to have a look at the sky, which we hadn't looked at. And if we had done, we would have found Cassiopeia.
That's right. That's right. And you were just going to design an array that could look at the circumpolar regions.
That's right.
You weren't thinking of going to the Southern Hemisphere on a Navy ship or something, were you?
We weren't that ambitious.
Right.
We were all working out time until we left, roughly speaking.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
I mean, it was a very lucky break for us. We
right.
really weren't a high-powered team, as I said in my letter.
Well, now tell me about the fluctuating source in the direction of the signal.